You're listening to a program produced in 2017 by Aloud, a series of dynamic conversations, readings, and performances that take place at the historic Central Library in downtown Los Angeles. Aloud is presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles, which supports the Los Angeles Public Library. To learn more, please visit lfla.org/aloud. Robert Sapolsky is, as the Stanford News recently observed, quote, a lot of things. A MacArthur Fellow who spent years studying a troop of baboons in Kenya, a neuroendocrinologist who changed the way we think about stress and the brain, an accomplished writer of popular science books, and a professor of biology at Stanford who has long been interested in what animals can tell us about our own behavior. Sapolsky is also a great prose stylist and a funny guy, able to move from academic lingo to straight talk in one sentence, like this passage. Here's an example about baboons, quote, they're a highly sexually dimorphic tournament species with extensive escalated aggression and a strong propensity towards frustration displacement, i.e., they can be intensely shitty to one another. Most recently, Dr. Sapolsky has been reflecting on the origins of human behavior, starting deep in the brain, moments before we act, and working his way millions of years back to the evolutionary pressures on our prehistoric ancestors' decisions, with stops along the way to consider how hormones, brain development, and social structures shape our behavior. In his new book, Behave, The Biology of Humans at Our Best and Worst, let's try that again. Some 11 years in the making, Dr. Sapolsky asks the big questions. What drives human behavior? Is free will an illusion? Has civilization made us better? Can we escape our tribal past? How is it humans are capable, on one hand, of mass genocide, and on the other, heroic self-sacrifice? And this is, as I'm sure you'll agree, a poignant week to be discussing these issues. One can't cover all those questions, and there are many more in 50 minutes tonight, but Dr. Sapolsky's conversation with Dr. Amy Parrish will surely touch on some of these paradoxes of human nature and the biology of our response to context and environment. Dr. Robert Sapolsky is a MacArthur Genius Fellow, a professor of biology and neurology at Stanford, and a research associate with the Institute of Primate Research at the National Museum of Kenya. His books include A Primate's Memoir, The Trouble with Testosterone, Why Zebras Don't Get Ulcers, and Monkey Loves, and other essays on our lives as animals. And we're really thrilled that Dr. Sapolsky is in conversation tonight with Dr. Amy Parrish. How many of you got to hear Amy last week with Yale ornithologist Richard O. Prum? That was a great discussion. Amy Parrish is a biological anthropologist, primatologist, and Darwinian feminist who's taught at USC in the Gender Studies, Arts and Letters, Anthropology, and Preventive Medicine program since 1999. She's been studying the world's captive population of bonobos for the last 20 years, and in all of her work, she uses an evolutionary approach to shed light on the origins of human behavior. Please join me in welcoming Dr. Amy Parrish and Dr. Robert Sapolsky to the stage of the LA Public Library.
Good evening, and thanks, Louise, for that terrific introduction, and thank you to all of you for being here tonight. And I'm really excited to be in conversation with Robert Sapolsky, whose interests are wide-ranging. He spent 10 or 11 years writing this tome that we're going to be discussing tonight that really talks about what causes a behavior. And I think in the final chapters we get to, it's complicated.
But, 11 years. You'd think.
But along the way, you cover such an interesting array of levels of analysis. And when I first started reading your book, I was struck by some of the conversations I've had with other academics where I feel as though we're not so much disagreeing as just talking about different levels. And In biology, we refer to that as maybe proximate versus ultimate levels of causation. So you could talk about the mechanism that makes something happen, or you can talk about how it evolved. And you're not necessarily disagreeing, you're just focusing on different parts of the process. And you've done an amazing job in this book exploring that from everything from the minute a behavior happens and what's going on with your neurons, back to what's going on with your hormones, back to your childhood, your gestation, the evolution of your ancestral line and perhaps your species. I think you illustrate the concept of this problem of different levels of causation in an interesting way when you pose the question, why did the chicken cross the road? And I wondered if you could tell us, why did the chicken cross the road?
Well, you see some female chicken that does something sexually solicitous with her wings or whatever it is that female chickens do. And this male chicken over there, as a result, very excitedly runs over, and thus, why did he cross the road? And the answer is obvious, which is if you're an anatomist, because the fulcrum of his chicken pelvis is whatever that allows him to locomote across. And if you're an endocrinologist, the obvious answer is because his androgen levels made him sensitive to the sexually solicitive whatever. And if you're an evolutionary biologist, the answer is because over the eons, male chickens who didn't respond to sexually solicitous gestures didn't pass on copies of their genes. So that's why he's running across the road. And it's different levels of explanation. And I think what sort of one of the sort of central notions in the book is, well, if you're a scientist, what you do for a living is spend a huge amount of time obsessing over tiny slivers of like knowledge. And thus, it's very easy to wind up deciding this is the part of the brain that explains this behavior, or the hormone, or the gene, or the childhood experience, or the evolutionary mechanism that explains everything, and a certain myopic whatever, and you know, a behavior occurs, and it's the outcome of the neurons 1 second before, and the sensory stimuli a minute before, and the hormones a day before, and all the way back to the evolutionary forces that made the species that you're part of what it is. And not only that all of those different factors have to be factored in, but ultimately they're all one and the same. If you're talking about genes, you're talking about evolution. If you're talking about the brain, you're talking about the childhood where the brain got wired together. You know, they're all intertwined.
So if we wanted to talk about, say, why human mothers love their babies, where would you start with a question like that, and how would you work it back?
Okay, so why did the human mother cross the road to get to her child? Well, sort of on the most proximal level, what's going on in the brain? There's areas of the limbic system, the emotional, highly mammalian part of the brain, that has to do with responding to sensory cues. And for example, like, here's a great detail: during pregnancy, if you're a female mammal, including humans, during pregnancy, you basically kill off all the neurons in your olfactory system and replace them with spanking new neurons, you adult neurogenesis. And what's this for? This is so that right around the time your child is born, you've got this brand new, newly renovated olfactory system to make you really, really good at identifying the individual smell of your child. What that also implies, incidentally, is thus during a large part of pregnancy, your olfactory system is totally screwy because the contractors got there late and the weather's bad and the whole project is going slower than expected. And no wonder foods and smells are all weird and out of whack at that point. So on that level, because the nervous system has been set up to key in on the sensory cues that this is your child, and it loops right into parts of the hypothalamus that have to do with things like milk letdown and stuff. Okay, so that's 1 second's worth of mechanistic stuff. But on a slightly longer span, because in the previous month or so, your brain has been marinating in this hormone oxytocin, which promotes mother-infant bonding and affiliative behavior with that. But taking further back, because in your childhood, you had a certain type of upbringing. Your mothering style is a predictor of one's own mothering style in adulthood. Abusive individuals bond less readily. Individuals who were abused as child bond less readily to their own children later on. And there's an epigenetic neurobiology as to what that's about. But further back, because in your fetal environment, you were exposed to just the right level of gonadal hormones from your mother's circulation. But further back, because of your genes for your oxytocin receptors in your brain, because there's different versions, and people's emotional expressiveness and affiliativeness seems to vary somewhat with what flavor of this gene you wind up having. But oh, then, all the way back to the evolution of your species, why it is that we have oxytocin forming that role, whereas in South American monkeys, oxytocin is mainly about females and males forming monogamous pair bonds. Yeah. So why did it happen? All these reasons.
Lots of different explanations. In reading your book, you talk about oxytocin and some other hormones like vasopressin. And I think a lot of us have heard of oxytocin because even some online dating services have talked about maybe developing an oxytocin spray. But there is also because it's supposed to be great for bonding and it's the feel-good hormone. It has this reputation. The downside of it isn't really advertised, but you write a little bit about the downside of oxytocin.
Well, what it sort of, when you think about humans being awful to each other, sort of the hormone that most readily comes to mind is, of course, testosterone, and why in every culture and every species, males are such a pain in the rear. And when you think about mammals being nice to each other, oxytocin immediately comes to mind. And what's interesting about both of them is this lesson of hormones and genes and brain are not causing behaviors. They're modulating your response to different circumstances. Both testosterone and oxytocin have incredibly distorted pictures as to what they actually do. Okay, testosterone. What does testosterone do? It makes you aggressive. Testosterone doesn't actually make you aggressive. It makes you magnify the social learning about aggression that you've already gotten. You take a group of five male rhesus monkeys. They've formed the dominance hierarchy, and take the guy in the middle, number three ranking one, and shoot him up with a ton of testosterone, like every neuron in his brain is growing antlers or something from that much testosterone. And so you would say, so does he now rise in the hierarchy? Does he go challenge number two and number one? Does he show new patterns of aggression? Not at all. What happens is he becomes a total miserable nightmare to numbers four and five. In other words, testosterone is not creating new patterns of aggression. It's just amplifying the social learning he's had of, oh, these guys I can torture. These guys I better brown nose. It just amplifies the social learning going on there. But it turns out testosterone does something even more amazing, because it turns out that testosterone does not so much have effects on aggression, but what it does is it makes organisms more likely to do whatever behavior is needed to hold on to high status when it's being challenged. If you're a baboon, that's aggression, because your status is being challenged by somebody and it's going to be an aggressive interaction. When you get to humans, though, it's much more complicated, because it is possible, for example, to have an economic game where, in fact, you accrue status by being more generous in your economic offers. And you give people testosterone when they're playing that game, and they become more generous. In other words, like if you took like 1,000 Buddhist monks and shot them up with testosterone, they would just like run amok doing random acts of kindness, seeing who got to do the most of them. And what I think that winds up teaching us is, the problem isn't that testosterone does something to aggression. The problem is we reward status for aggression so readily. Nice. Meanwhile, on the flip side, oxytocin has like a virtually mirrored distortion. So oxytocin is great for mother-infant bonding and pair bonding and emotional expressiveness and generosity. And like you give rats oxytocin and they become better listeners. And like you give them to fruit flies and they sing like Joan Baez. And it's like a wonderful hormone. It just promotes all this great stuff. Until you look at more closely, and some recent research showing that oxytocin has all these pro-social effects for people when you're interacting with who feel like us's in-group members. And what oxytocin does at the same time is make you awful to thems more xenophobic, more preemptively aggressive in economic games and such. There was this one great study showing this. A lot of this work has come from the Netherlands. And this was a group of volunteers, and they were given like this classic problem in philosophy, the runaway trolley problem. Would you push one person on the track in order to save five, and the utilitarian one? And, you know, philosophers have been thinking about trolleys for millennia in terms of this. And so this is a standard one. So they gave them the runaway trolley problem, but they did something interesting, which is the person you either were going to or not push onto the tracks got a name. And a third of the time, they got what's apparently like a standard, like, Netherlandish name, like Dirk or something like that. Then the rest of the time, they tapped in to the two groups that consistently evoke negative stereotypes in people from the Netherlands: Germans. Oh, right, World War II, that's right, that happened. And Islamic individuals. So now you were doing the runaway trolley problem, deciding, were you going to push Dirk in front of the trolley, or Otto, or Mahmoud? And that had no effect on the choices people made until you gave them oxytocin. And then you're much less likely to push good old Dirk onto the track, but you can't like get Wolfgang and Ahmed thrown under the trolley fast enough. Oxytocin doesn't make us nicer. It makes us nicer to people who feel like us's, and it makes us lousy to others.
So it's a bonding hormone, and it could be to your particular social group, but it could even be within a pair bond, right? You have some really interesting data on men who are exposed to oxytocin and what they do when there's an attractive researcher in the room. Can you talk about that?
Okay, that one. oh, the embarrassing things that people will volunteer for. In this one, they gave guys oxytocin, and your normal, unattached, heterosexual male, when given oxytocin, and now filling out some like absurd questionnaire having nothing to do with the experiment, with a female researcher who's attractive, greatly decreases the interpersonal difference, distance there. But however, if he's in a stable relationship, it increases the distance, because somehow that significant other is lurking in the background of his unconscious to a greater extent. I mean, males. Okay, here's this. Like, I'm amazed by this literature. What can I say? Pathetic. If you take a guy, heterosexual male, who's waiting at a bus stop, and there is an attractive woman nearby, on the average, males will wait longer to get on the bus, so that they have to dash heroically in a gladiatorial fashion to get on the bus at the very last moment. Have the same thing going on, and males do more risk-taking in a gambling game. They're more preemptively aggressive in an economic game. Females, put females at bus stops, and you know, Brad Pitt could be there, and has no effect. This is a male-specific effect there. And once again, just biological influences mumbling. So why did you wait for the very last second to get that bus? Oh, I don't know. We know. That's right.
It reminds me of an Austrian researcher, Karl Grammer, did some work with women leaving Viennese nightclubs, and he videotaped them in their outfits and then had them spit in little tubes and figured out their cycle state, and found that women were most likely to be out alone at ovulation showing the most skin if they were in long-term relationships. And if you ask them, why did you wear that outfit and why are you out without your partner, they had no idea. But the correlation was there, that something is driving you. You feel this, you don't know why you put on the miniskirt.
They'd have no idea, or they would post hoc come up with a wonderfully, seemingly rational explanation.
Yeah, and that's interesting, because as a primatologist, I wonder if you feel the same way. I feel like there's very little about us that's actually truly unique. Most of our characteristics fall along some kind of spectrum. But if there is something that might be unique, I feel as though it's our ability to overlay a layer of explanation onto what we do that might have very little to do with why we actually do things. Or we measure all other animals based on the outcome. You sit there in the Serengeti and you watch the cheetahs, or in your case, you sit in Kenya and watch the baboons, and then you write down what they did. You don't ask them why they did it, right?
Well, they lie, for one thing. But no, We lie. We rationalize. That's exactly the case.
And the best way to lie is to lie to yourself, right? So then you're convincing.
Which is very, very human thing. I mean, over and over, the theme with us, especially when looking at the biological regulation of our behavior, is we're exactly like every other species out there. We don't have any hormones that are unique to humans. We don't have any neurotransmitters, no brain regions. We're exactly like all the others until you look closely. And then we're using the same old plumbing in utterly bizarre, unique ways. I mean, sort of a very hot field in sort of behavioral biology these days is the fact that, well, depending on your tastes, either that other species show empathy or empathy-like behavior, depending on how much you're resistant to that being something to describe other than a human. But rats will lever press to keep another individual rat who is in pain from getting shocks. Chimps show all sorts of aspects of empathy that Franz de Waal has done wonderful work on. So cool. Rats could be empathic. It comes with the same fine print as with us. They're not empathic to any old rat. It's got to be a cage mate who they like, who they extend empathy to, comes with a, but it depends who. Okay, so wow, they're just like us. But we're the only species that could sit there and feel empathy for an animal, a member of another species, or a child in a refugee camp on the other side of the globe, or, oh my God, the poor Navi when Home Tree was destroyed in Avatar. They're pixels. They're not real. Yet we feel fictional characters. We can extrapolate, we can abstract these feelings over sort of space and time in ways that no other species can.
I remember Richard Wrangham and Barb Smuts at University of Michigan wrote a paper about how humans can have relationships with people they've never met. So you can take your first trip to Ireland and knock on somebody's door and say, I'm your third cousin once removed on Aunt Mary's side, and they will welcome you in. And that may be something that...
That as well. Or like online dating, you can fall in love with someone and you don't even know what they smell like. Like, that doesn't make any sense to a mammal. That's weird.
In San Diego, they used to, a radio station put on an event called Mile of Men, where they would get all these eligible bachelors to line up along a road and give them numbers. And it's Southern California, so women would drive by in their car. And then if you're the first to call the radio station, you get a date that they pay for with this man of your choice. And as a biologist, I was thinking, if the women can't smell them, how can you choose one? If you...
I know.
But they would put little printouts, or they would put biographical information on the website, and the women would print it out, and it wouldn't tell you which number, but you would know that somewhere out there is the 6'5" Navy SEAL with all these characteristics that you might want.
So was this paid for with taxpayers' money?
No, but I found it a really fascinating opportunity to go down and interview the women on what they're looking for.
I'll bet you did. That was perfect.
So yeah, it's interesting. I think that certainly your baboon background must shed some interesting light on how you look at humans. Where do you see some salient connections between what you've learned from baboons and how it informed your human perspective?
Certainly has made faculty meetings make a whole lot more sense
over Amen, the years, brother.
But. Oh, the number of colleagues I wish I could have blowgunned in the rear and then take some blood samples when they were down. But that would just be out of vindictiveness. Well, once again, it's a, wow, they're just like us until you look more closely. For example, okay, so two examples. One of the things I looked at a lot over the years is what does a baboon's dominance rank have to do with his health? Like, who's got the rotten cholesterol levels, who's got the elevated blood pressure. And on first pass, what it looks like is, you know, if you have a choice in the matter, you don't want to be a low-ranking baboon because your life is incredibly psychologically stressed. So, whoa, exactly the same as in human studies of corporate worlds and studies of socioeconomic stratum, and it's much the same. But then we do something different because, unlike baboons, we belong to multiple hierarchies at the same time. And what we're really good at with that human capacity to rationalize is whichever hierarchy we're highest ranking in, that's the one we move to the forefront of our minds and significance. So you've got somebody who's got the worst, the lowest status job in some big corporation, but this is the captain of the company softball team, or this is someone who's a deacon at their church, or this, and you better bet they can tell you exactly why 9 to 5 is stupid and pointless and is just there to pay the bills, and what really matters is that other setting, because we've got multiple hierarchies. So another thing, sort of with the baboons, sort of the what it took me about 20 years to learn with the baboons, is even more important than being a high-ranking baboon is being a socially affiliated one. Like, if you want to have low stress hormone levels, much better to have a lot of grooming partners than to be an alpha male. Okay, so the health protective effects of socialization, just like us. But then you look at stuff like, okay, in westernized cultures and individualist societies, when people are stressed and depressed, they tend to get together with friends more, and that's stress-reducing. In East Asian collectivist societies, same exact thing. Except in westernized societies, what happens when you're feeling depressed and you get together with a friend is you bitch and moan about how awful you feel. And what happens in collectivist societies, you get together and you ask them how they're doing, and you reify group values. So, okay, wow, we're just like baboons, social affiliations, but culture... culture producing diametrically ways in which it's carried out. Oh, all these extra layers that make us more complicated.
So I wonder if you've encountered this in academia. I've met a lot of social scientists who will just go to the mat to argue that there's nothing about us that's dictated by our biology in any way, or that biology is even relevant. So in the gender studies department, a colleague once said that we shouldn't have a class called sex similarities and differences because there are no differences except those that are culturally imposed. What do you do with something like that? I mean, I don't know any biologists who would argue on a nature-nurture spectrum that we're all nature, but I know a lot of social scientists would argue that we're all nurture. Your book, I think, does a wonderful job of navigating and expanding the possibilities for how we look at the interface and the interaction between nature and nurture.
Well, it's probably the best antidote is to show somebody circumstances in which your behavior is being determined by a biological factor. A biological factor you're unaware of, a biological factor that no one in their right mind could have ever thought that makes a difference. Just some examples. Okay, so this whole notion, so why did this behavior occur 1 second before? Because the brain did this. A couple of minutes before, because these sensory stimuli occurred in the environment, which caused the neurons to do something earlier. Okay, so what sort of sensory stimuli? If you take just a picture of two pairs of eyes and put them up on a bus stop, people litter less around there. You put it up on the screen of a computer and people cheat less in an online game because something's tapping into a sense of being watched. You give somebody some really foul-tasting liquid to drink, like cod liver oil or something, and in the minute afterward, they're much more condemning of moral transgressions on the parts of people because you're somehow confusing gustatory disgust with moral disgust. Take somebody, I love this one, take somebody and they fill out a questionnaire about their political views and their views about social issues and economic issues and geopolitical ones. If someone is sitting in a room with smelly garbage, they become more socially conservative. It has no effect on their geopolitical views, their economic views. All that's happening there is subliminally something kind of smells disgusting. And that's just begging circuitry in your brain, which does the same thing with sensory disgust as with moral disgust, to decide that not only are they different, but that different thing is wrong, wrong, wrong. Or this is another study. This was a study done, published in this very prestigious journal, Proceedings, the National Academy of Sciences, and it studied more than 5,000 courtroom decisions about parole, a parole board by single judges, and they looked at, over the course of this, sort of what were the predictors of who got parole and who was sent back to jail, and the single best predictor was how many hours it had been since the judge had eaten a meal. Oh my God. Right after lunch, about a 90% rate of granting parole. Right before lunch, about a 10% rate. So that's, and like a straight line down from there. Okay, so what's amazing about that, at least for me, one is like we kind of know the neurobiology of that, how that works. There's this part of the brain, the frontal cortex, which is really hardworking and does extraordinary stuff like long-term planning and impulse control and extraordinary stuff like perspective taking, trying to view the world from somebody else's standpoint. And it's the most expensive part of the brain. And if you're hypoglycemic, the part of your brain that's most sort of whacked out as a result is the frontal cortex. And thus, it's that much harder to sit there and say, wait a second, what's the world look like from this person's perspective? Just it's the more impulsive, they haven't changed, they never will change, send them back. I mean, there's a known neurobiology of this. If your blood sugar levels drop, your frontal cortex doesn't work as well thinking about the world from somebody else's perspective or doing the months of the year backwards rapidly. Both of those are frontal tasks. Give somebody a sugary drink versus a drink filled with an artificial sweetener, and the frontal cortex works better afterward. So it's amazing, for one thing, that like we even understand the biology of that. But the thing that's even more amazing to me is if you took one of those judges 2 seconds after they made one of those decisions and said, hey, so why do you throw this person back in the slammer, or why do you give this person... And they're going to quote like Immanuel Kant to you or something, or Schopenhauer or something. And no, it's because of how much ATP there is in your frontal cortical neurons. And it's the cognition playing catch up afterward, because a huge amount of the time we're saying, I can't quite put my finger on it, why, but... that's wrong. Give me a couple of seconds and I'll figure out why it actually makes perfect sense why that's wrong when they do that. And that's all post hoc.
Does that relate to implicit bias in any way?
Yeah.
Yeah? Can you talk a little bit about our brains and implicit bias and how we're going to solve some of our social problems? Like,
all right, this is like fiendishly clever test for showing exactly what your unconscious automatic biases are, and you can do these tests online. Just go to like IAT, implicit association test, IAT at harvard.edu, because the tests originated there. And it doesn't ask you your opinions about anything. It doesn't ask you anything conscious. All it does is take advantage of the fact that when two things that don't seem to belong together appear, you process them ever so slightly slower than when two things that make perfect sense together. So, for example, suppose you've got like this deep-seated hostile prejudice against trolls. So what they do is you're sitting there with a computer screen and they're either flashing up pictures of trolls or of humans and back and forth and back and forth, and then they're either flashing up words that have positive connotations, heroic, generous, well-groomed, or negative ones, malodorous, untrustworthy, or whatever, and then they start flashing them up in pairs. And if you've got this deep-seated bias against trolls and a big preference for humans, when you see human and delightful, you are supposed to press a button. You process it milliseconds faster than if you have like human and backstabbing. Wait, no, it's the trolls who are backstabbing. You take like 10 milliseconds longer and do enough of these in these two categories, and you can detect if somebody has a cognitive bias. What's amazing is a study that came out of Yale a few years ago showing it's the same thing in other primates. And what they did in this one was, it was either pictures of monkeys from your group or stranger monkeys, us's and them's, and then rather than words with positive or negative connotations, pictures of things with positive or negative. If your monkey raisins are positive, tropical fruit is positive, snakes are negative, spiders are negative, and then they flash them up in pairs, and the monkey has been trained, if it's a picture of a them or a scary thing, you press this, and monkeys do the same thing. They pause ever so slightly when you give them discordant pairings of like, hey, we're the ones who are like luscious tropical fruit. They're the ones who are like spiders, not the other way around. So, wow, it's just like us. They can even have automatic categories of thems make them automatically think of things like spiders and snakes. Wow, just like us, but no other primate on Earth has ever gone and killed somebody who's a them over ideology or theology or what gang colors they're wearing or what like flavor or version of God they think exists. And oh, so we're doing something very special and different with that.
sort of Dr. Seuss butter side up, butter side down wars, right? That's exactly. Really interesting. Richard Alexander in the 80s wrote a book called Biology of Moral Systems, and in it he gave rules for when you should give and when you should take. So a big topic in biology is, why should you ever cooperate? Why should you ever be altruistic? Why should you do something nice, pay a cost to give somebody else a benefit? Those kinds of questions. And he had this whole list, which was like, take whenever you can get away with it. Take whenever the value of what you're taking exceeds the punishment you're going to get for having taken it. Give when you have no choice, or when the costs of not giving exceed the costs of resisting, etc. It made it seem like we're really hardwired in particular ways that we can't escape. Your book really is more like, I would say, Robert Axelrod's book on the evolution of cooperation. At the end, he gives all kinds of hope for the future, that you can enlarge the shadow of the future. You can teach people to be more cooperative. And on the biological level, can you just talk a little bit about our capacities for change and plasticity? And
huge capacity. I mean, sort of dogma used to be your brain is pretty much set in stone shortly after birth. We know that's not the case. We know parts of the brain, the frontal cortex, does not fully develop till you're about 25 years old. But even more importantly, this whole new field of neural plasticity is that the brain changes forever after. In parts of your brain, you're making new neurons your entire lifetime. Depending on the experience, neurons shrivel up, they form new connections, they remap. Spend a summer learning to play a musical instrument, and by the end of the summer, your auditory cortex will have remapped so that more space is being devoted to the sound of your instrument. Get somebody, this one is astonishing, get somebody who was born deaf and is fluent in American Sign Language, and American Sign Language is a visual process. You look at somebody signing, and your visual cortex processes it. Not someone who is fluent in ASL, they look at somebody signing, and their auditory cortex activates. It is completely remapped, showing it's not the movement, it's the meaning, and the meaning is sort of evolutionarily embedded in auditory parts of the brain. So like incredible plasticity, wow, that's totally cool. It's value-free, because sometimes you need a very plastic brain in order for you to change into being saintly, and some of the time you need a plastic brain to change into learning how to ethnically cleanse a village. So nervous systems change. Nervous systems change, but it's for better or worse. Amid that, I mean, one of the domains that I find where something that's hardwired about us nonetheless leaves some room for optimism, and you've sort of inferred that sort of us-them dichotomies. We, like all sorts of other primates out there, are incredibly hardwired to divide the world into us's and thems and to not be all that nice to thems. Our brains process it in milliseconds by categories. Within like 50 to 100 milliseconds, parts of our brain differentiate depending on if you've seen the face of somebody of a different race, a different gender, a different age group, a different socioeconomic status. Signs, like incredibly rapid processing. And one of the most depressing literatures out there in all of behavioral biology is you take your average person and you put them in a brain scanner and you're flashing up pictures of faces and flash up a face of somebody of a different race and the amygdala activates, a part of the brain that has to do with fear and aggression. And a part of the brain called the fusiform that processes faces doesn't activate as much as if you're looking at the face of someone of your own race. They don't register as much faceness, and you don't remember it with the same accuracy. Oh my God, that's the most depressing literature out there, is dividing the world into us and thems along racial lines. Is that an inevitability? Totally depressing until you look a little more closely, because it doesn't happen with everyone, and it's easy to set things up so it doesn't happen. Who does it not happen to? If you've grown up in a racially diverse neighborhood, that's not a relevant us-them category. Your amygdala doesn't activate. Suppose instead, this was wonderful work done by Susan Fiske at Princeton, get somebody in that situation and you say to them, okay, I'm going to be showing you a bunch of pictures here of faces. And with each face, there is or isn't a little red dot somewhere on the picture. And press a button if you see the red dot. Now in a picture of a face, if another race comes up, amygdala doesn't activate. Yeah, you're not processing the face. You're just looking for the dot there. Now instead, you're instructed, when this face comes up, hit this button or that, depending if the person looks as if they're more than 40 years old. In other words, think of them categorically. That category doesn't override the racial categorization. Now say to them, I'm going to show you these faces, and for each one of them, press this button, this depending on if you think this person likes broccoli. Broccoli. This is not like
George Bush doesn't like broccoli.
George, and I was, that's sure. If he did, we wouldn't have gone into the Gulf War or something. Not a whole lot of blood has been spilled over like broccoli, cauliflower, us them dichotomies. So what you do then is the person is sitting there, and now with each face, they've got to think, okay, is this the sort of person who would like broccoli? Implicitly, you're thinking of them in a market. You're thinking of them sitting down to dinner, eating a meal. Do they like the taste? You're thinking of them as an individual. And the amygdala doesn't respond because you've biased the person, you've primed the person to individuate them and not to think of them as simply being part of a category. Totally cool. But what we also have as another measure of it is at any given point, we've got all sorts of us-them dichotomies in our heads. And which one seems most pressing can be shifted to the forefront. So now you do the exact same study, and like your same race or other race, and amygdala is lighting up in most people. And now the person in each case has a baseball cap on. And either has the logo for the Dodgers, which, as far as I know, they play in Brooklyn, because I'm not very attuned to sports. But I assume the Dodgers have some sort of rival team. Giants. Okay, they're from San Francisco. I'm from San Francisco. They're my hometown team. I've heard of them. Okay, so now you flash up. Either they've got a Dodgers cap or a Giants cap, and that category overrides race. If it's a Giants fan cap, regardless of race, now your amygdala activates. If it's a Dodgers cap, your fusiform activates more and you're processing their face more. Whoa, oh, racism, the most inevitable us-them fault line that we have, and blood has been spilled for. Stupid baseball cap takes precedence in terms of how we categorize who counts as a pertinent us. So the bad news is I think we are indeed hardwired as to us-them dichotomies, but we are so easily manipulated as to who counts as an us or who counts as a them in any given second. And I think there's a lot of room for optimism in that one.
That's really interesting. There's a climate change scientist she's a woman who's an evangelical Christian. I heard a story about her on NPR, and so when she's talking to an evangelical Christian group, she has to establish rapport with them first by establishing all of her credentials, her religious credentials, that we have all of this in common. We believe the same evangelical things, and then kind of slowly ease into the climate change. Obviously, when she's with scientists, they're deeply suspicious of the evangelical Christian side, so she has to really emphasize her scientific credentials, and then kind of present it as, well, there's an opportunity to talk to people who are not like you if you...
And we have to be very skillful at knowing what the markers are of different tribes.
Right. What's going on in the adolescent brain? You have a chapter, what's it called, Dude, Where's My Frontal Cortex? Is that what it's called?
yes. Well, it turns out all of adolescence is explained by one very simple neurobiological fact, which is the entire brain is going full blast at that point, especially the dopamine system, which has to do with reward and anticipation. The whole brain is completely up to speed except for the frontal cortex, because the frontal cortex isn't fully developed until we're about 25. It's the last part of the brain to mature by miles. Basically, the rest of the brain is wired up by the time you're about 5 years old, and the frontal cortex takes another 20 years to get there. So what's the implication of that? First off, it explains why adolescents are adolescent in their behaviors and disinhibition. That one single fact was a big explanatory sort of motivation for why some years ago the Supreme Court ruled that you can't execute somebody for crimes they did under age 18. And they explicitly wrote, I think it was Kennedy, wrote in the decision about brain maturation in the adolescent brain, which was wonderful. The one sort of logical flaw there was their sort of neurobiological assumption that magically on the morning of your 18th birthday, something happened to your brain and now you had an adult brain. For me, though, what's the most interesting implication of that is if the frontal cortex is the last part of the brain to fully mature, by definition, then, it is the part of the brain that is most sculpted by environment and experience and least influenced by genes. And it's got to be that way. Like, when you look at, okay, your visual cortex is wired up by the time you're five, and it's going to take another 20 years for your frontal cortex to get there. Is the frontal cortex a more difficult construction project? Are there different types of neurons? Is there more complicated wiring? Absolutely not. It's not that it's harder to put a frontal cortex together. It's that we've evolved this delayed maturation. Because what does the frontal cortex do? It learns situational ethics. It learns how to tell the difference between something that's really meant and hypocrisy. It learns the difference as to when in your culture it's not okay to kill somebody and when it is, because it differs in every culture. It does all of that like complex, subtle stuff, because if what the frontal cortex does is make you do the harder thing when it's the right thing to do, what counts as the harder thing is very, very context-dependent. I mean, think about it. The frontal cortex plays an absolutely central role in keeping us from lying. However, somewhere along the way, we have to learn it's okay to lie. It's okay to lie if you're saying to grandma, for example, no, I don't have that toy. I'm so glad you gave it to me. Or to lie if saying, no, I'm not harboring any refugees in my attic. Absolutely not. So sometimes lying is okay and sometimes it's not. So the frontal cortex is what keeps you from lying in circumstances where it's not okay. But as soon as you've decided you are going to lie, your frontal cortex is what makes you good at it, because you have to control your facial expressions and where your eye contact is and keep your voice from getting. So wait, this part of the brain makes it possible for you to keep track of what lies are okay and which ones aren't, and to lie effectively when you are going to lie, but to resist the types of lies that are the bad ones, and somehow to keep all that straight. No wonder it has an insane metabolic rate and it takes 25 years to wire up, because that's all the culture-specific stuff and all the difference between what I say and what I do and de facto and de jure, and all of that stuff is subtle, and there's no way genes can handle it.
And part of that developmental process is being able to take the perspective of another, right? Which is
which is a hugely difficult task. I mean, psychologists love this. It's this thing called theory of mind. Mm-hmm. When you can first realize that somebody else has different information than you have, and developmental psychologists love sort of when kids first show it, and there's all these formal tests, and like kids roughly ages 3 to 5 is when they get theory of mind. Like, my kids got it on their third birthdays, of course. but that's sort of a first step of these gradations. Ah, somebody has different information than I do. Somebody has different feelings than me. Somebody is capable of hurting at a time that I don't. Then the much more subtle, complicated one, somebody is made to feel better by things that wouldn't necessarily work for me. My solution isn't necessarily theirs. And like, you know, like, here's this one sentence. Beat me, said the masochist. No, said the sadist. Try telling that one to a chimp as to what that one's about. And, you know, this is very complicated. What works for them is not what working for you. And that's very challenging.
That said, I have to say, in defense of chimps, that they do have a theory of mind. And you can,
yes,
for instance...
they do.
bury fruit in an enclosure and they know it's there somewhere and they run around looking for it. This is an example from Franz de Waal. And then let's say nobody finds the fruit that day. And then suddenly in the middle of the group afternoon nap, a very low-ranking male will just pop up. It's clear he hasn't been asleep at all, make a beeline directly to where the buried fruit is and eat it as silently as possible. So right. That shows that he understands that others haven't seen the fruit. He's yep. decided to wait. He's decided to be quiet, not to direct attention.
It's wonderful stuff. Yeah. Again, just like us, but totally different. What in general, chimps will only show theory of mind when they're highly motivated. There's no chimp who would sit there and do the work to try to figure out who's in love with who in Midsummer Night's Dream. Like that, they just won't follow it and they're not interested.
They're definitely a lot less patient than us, for sure, for one thing. They're definitely wired.
But if there was a good food riding on, if they could keep that straight, then they'd be motivated. Right. So once again, yeah, exactly the same
and yet different. Yeah, you had a list of descriptive words: aggression, violence, competition, envy, compassion, empathy, sympathy, cooperation, altruism, reconciliation, spite, forgiveness, schadenfreude, reciprocity, love. And you know, I was thinking that most of those, to some degree, apply to most of the other primates. I'm not sure about schadenfreude. And then, of course, how you define love would be up for grabs. But I've had interesting conversations with philosophers over the years about whether chimpanzees and bonobos in particular could apologize, for instance. So Kanzi, the language-trained bonobo, bit off somebody's finger once on purpose because he was angry about something, a human's finger, and then wanted to meet this guy again. And the guy said, "I'm only going to meet you if you apologize." And this was all done through intermediaries, and Kanzi uses a computer keyboard. And Kanzi said, "No, I'm not going to apologize." So there's a standoff for a couple months every day. "Will you apologize?" "No." And then finally one day he said, "All right, I'll apologize." And they brought them together, and there was all this hugging, and Kanzi was screaming. And, but philosophers absolutely refuse to accept that this could be an apology. So they'll say it's a Western Christian concept, or it started with the French Revolution, a sense of, you know, a sense of fairness, you know, and therefore a sense of unfairness. But if I say, well, okay, maybe most of what humans do is not something philosophical like an apology, it's reconciliation, they're more willing to accept that we are like other animals in that way than that other animals are more like us. You have a fascinating anecdote about something that happened with your baboons when, to all the alpha males, that radically changed the social system. And for me, it's given me hope for humans that some of our worst behaviors or worst social traits are maybe not set in stone. Can you tell us?
This was in the mid-80s with one of my baboon troops, and the troop next door to it, the next territory over, hit the jackpot. They had a tourist lodge in their territory, and the lodge opened up a big new garbage dump. And like in every national park on earth, there's the problem of how to keep wild animals away from the garbage. And it wasn't working very well there. And this was like a lodge dumping all the leftover, like turkey whatevers and British sludge pudding desserts and whatever there. And like just all this leftover food stuff being dumped in there. And the neighboring troop basically moved into the garbage dump. They stopped foraging. They just lived in the trees. They slept in the trees above the dump. They'd waddle down every morning at like 8:58 when the garbage tractor would come and dump the stuff. Baboons are usually up around 6:30 starting to like interact. And I did some studies on this troop. They got borderline diabetes. They got elevated insulin and triglyceride levels. They got tooth decay. You know, a Western diet, all the usual. So I don't quite know how this works, but in some way, my baboons, a couple of kilometers away, got word of the garbage dump. Like, I don't know how this worked, but got word of the garbage dump, and it evolved that each morning about half of my males would pick up and run a couple of kilometers over to the garbage dump there to join in on the feasting. So it was not random who did this. So you're some baboon, and you're going to pick up and show up in another troop's territory, and you're planning to, like, be able to get in there on the feeding when there's 80 of them sort of ripping apart the food there. You're not going to do this unless you're aggressive. So these were the aggressive individuals in the troop. In addition, baboons do most of their socializing in the morning. That's where they haven't really started foraging yet. They're sitting around, they're grooming, they're gossiping, whatever. So these were guys who were sufficiently socially unconnected that they were willing to forego this each day to instead go fight for garbage. So in other words, the ones going for garbage were the most aggressive, least affiliated members of my troop. There came a tuberculosis outbreak, which after a great deal of work, I was able to show was due to bovine tuberculosis in tubercular meat, which a meat inspector at the lodge was being bribed to accept. And thus, some tubercular meat was winding up in the dump. Tuberculosis in humans, you got enough time to write Magic Mountain for thousands of pages. In non-human primates, TB is just wildfire. It kills you within weeks or so. So before it was over with, it basically had killed everybody in that troop, and it killed all my males who went there for garbage. Thus, we were left with a very different troop. For one thing, at half the number of males as usual, a 2-to-1 female-to-male ratio, which is quite atypical for baboons. But most importantly, the surviving males were nice guys. They were the least aggressive, most socially affiliated. So this completely transformed the atmosphere of the troop. There was much less aggression. There was more grooming. There was more animals sitting in social contact. Stress hormone levels went down. Their immune systems worked better. These were all things I documented. So that was, like, totally amazing and wonderful. But then the most interesting thing was I was, well, basically a little bit distressed to have lost my troop. So I sort of picked up and moved about 40 miles to the other end of the park to start on a new population there and wouldn't go anywhere near this corner of the park for long afterward until about a decade later and my soon-to-be wife came out to meet the baboons. And sort of I finally decided it was time to go back to this part of the park and at least sort of show her where that troop had been and went back. And the troop was still like that. They were still very socially affiliated. They sat in close contact. Okay, but something interesting had happened, which is all of the males who had survived the TB crisis had long since died. And this was a decade later. So who were the new adult males in the troop? Baboons, males around puberty, pick up and they leave their home troop and they join some other neighboring troop, anywhere from the one next door to one 30 miles away, and they now spend their baboon career in this new troop. In other words, by a decade later, all of the adult males in the troop had come in after growing up in a normal baboon troop and had transferred in after this new culture had come in. In other words, all of them came in as the same jerky adolescent male baboons that you would find in any other setting. And somehow or other, they learned, we don't do stuff like that here. And what I then spent sort of the next decade with that troop on was seeing what was the mechanism for, and this is a term that like social anthropologists would have apoplexy over, but what was the mechanism for this non-human primate cultural transmission of this social culture? And it turned out it had a whole lot to do with the females being more affiliative with new males, and it took about 6 months for these jerky males to stop being jerky. I mean, one of the things I immediately wondered was it in some way self-selective? Because baboon males, when they're transferring, will often go check out a few troops and then they pick which one they join. So I was wondering, was there like some sort of self-selection for the less aggressive guys? I always thought of this as the, well, who would choose to go to Reed College model of baboon transfer? But you looked at them, and they were just as aggressive and jerky as any other male baboons transferring. So here's this cultural transmission, and this is going on. And what most struck me was from like the early 60s, baboons have not just figuratively, but have literally been the textbook example of highly aggressive, stratified, hierarchical, male-dominated primates. And this is what evolution has produced. And all it took was one generation, and they came up with a completely different social system that was transmissible multi-generationally. And essentially what that means is anybody who says there's inevitabilities about human cultural systems and our least palatable ones knows nothing about humans or baboons. They don't have a leg to stand on.
That's right. And so it's a real message of hope that, you know, yes, our behavior is grounded in our biology, but it's not inevitable and it's not universal. And culture has a huge impact. With that, I'd like to open it up to the audience. I'd like to just explain how this is going to work. So we have people here from the library. If you raise your hand, they will bring a microphone around, and they'll try to get to as many as possible. We'll give a little signal when we have time for just a couple more questions. If you could help us by making sure your question is actually a question, that would help us to get through as many people as we possibly can.
Hi. Early on in your conversation, you were using the word, you know, talk about explanations and how we as humans rationalize, and I found myself looking through the index to see if you were talked about narrative at all, because I've been involved with making narrative as part of my life, and I have this belief that I used to believe, and I'm. It sounds, from what you're saying tonight, I already think I'm wrong in thinking that one of the things that's different between humans and other animals is that they may have all these things, but we can tell a story about it. And I think that can be a good thing if we can share our stories. But I'm wondering whether that idea of narrative being able to bring us closer together or not knowing narrative might make us sociopathic because we can't have consequences, you know, and how that fits in, whether or not people can construct a narrative.
Great. for me, the most interesting thing about narratives is the way they can diverge from reality. They can be self-serving. They can be propagandistic. They can be inspirational beyond, I mean, look at eulogies. What eulogies are a way of, like, you know, sugarcoating, you know, the best traits in somebody and completely de-emphasizing, usually in a way that reifies group values and family values and all that. You know, narratives, what's most interesting, the ways in which they are serving a purpose other than being, like, directly factual. And in that regard, I think that's very much human because really most other species do not have the capacity to separate the message from the messenger to the extent that we can, and thus manipulate the space in between. Or when they try to do it, they're terrible at it. I mean, for example, say a dog. When dogs are scared, when they're terrified, they release fear pheromones, a lot of which are coming out of their anal glands, and the fear pheromones are heavily made up of some of the breakdown of hormone products having to do with activating the fight or flight response and adrenaline, and like a dog does that. There's lots of circumstances where we would want to not show that we are afraid. We're poker-faced, we're negotiations, whatever, where we're trying to present a narrative that is biologically different from what the reality is. Dogs would love to do that. If they're in the dominance interaction and they're terrified of the guy they're facing, they would just as well not be releasing fear pheromones all over the place. They would love to be lying, but they can't do that because there's no distance between the meaning of the physiology and the physiology itself. So what does a dog do? The most lame sort of unsuccessful attempt to lie possible, the dog puts its tail between its legs and tries to snuff out the anal gland so that stuff can't come out. And what's the dog doing? It's saying, "Oh, I'm not scared, not me," says Sparky. And like, dogs aren't very good at that. But we are, because there's a biological distance between our messages and the underlying biology that motivated it. And the space in between we call symbols, we call abstractions or whatever, and we can do incredibly interesting things with that, and other species generally can't. So I think that's a big human non-human divide.
All right, where are we going next?
Okay. I was curious, with all your research and observations, how has it informed your perspective and perhaps theories on the concept of free will?
Oh, okay. Any tough questions out here to ask? Oddly enough, that's actually not a tough question for me. I used to be sort of polite or conciliatory and say something like, well, if there is free will, it's in all sorts of boring places. Like, if you want to claim it was free will, why you, like, flossed your bottom teeth before your top teeth this morning instead of the other way around, go ahead, it's free will, whatever. But if there is free will, it's in less and less interesting places, and it keeps getting crammed in closer. I think basically, you know, it's not possible to review sort of the entire set of knowledge of biological influences on behavior and come out the other end with any notion that amid all this biology, there's some little non-biological homunculus thingy guy sitting there in your brain who's in your brain but not of it and has a separate little control panel. And sure, the homunculus tries to keep up with the science journals and remember some of it but never liked biology that much and is willing to make silly decisions sometimes if it has to, like, rush back to the control panel from the bathroom or something. And there's this thing up there which, after all the biology happens, there's this free will thing that somehow is separate from all the laws of the physical universe. For me, all free will is the biology we haven't discovered yet.
That's and a great quote.
I have no trouble at all accepting that to be the fact, and I cannot begin to imagine what the world is supposed to look like in a world in which we don't believe there is free will. I can't imagine that one, and I suspect I'm simply a couple of centuries too early to be able to think that way, because we can do that in some ways. And an example that I always grab onto is, you know, 500 years ago, if somebody had an epileptic seizure, there was an explanation for what caused that. And the explanation was obvious, which was it was demonic possession. And the therapeutic intervention was obvious, which is you burn the person at the stake. And, like, bleeding heart liberals in the 1500s knew that was the explanation for epilepsy. And somewhere in the West, I don't know, 100, 200 years ago, there was a massive shift. And what we learned to do instead was to say, oh, it's not him, it's his disease. Oh, it's not that he slept with Satan, it's that he's got, like, screwy potassium channel genes in this part of his brain, because we now know that's a cause of epilepsy. We've done that shift. It's inconceivable to us now that, like, epilepsy is, like, something worthy. It's a neurological disorder. Like, don't talk to me about satanic possession. It's a neurological disorder, and it's a neurological disorder where one may need to constrain the person's behavior, as in, if somebody has treatment-resistant epilepsy, often they're not allowed to drive. But it would never, ever be the case that a whole bunch of goiterous, yapping peasants would grab burning torches and gather around to burn the driver's licenses of epileptics and think they were doing God's work or doing justice or... No, it's a biological constraint, and it's got nothing to do with, like, any of this volition stuff. So, you know, 500 years we've managed to get that one under our belts. We're nowhere near as good with, did this person do this because they are a violent, rotten, even evil person, or because they have psychotic schizophrenia, paranoid schizophrenia. About half of juries are pretty good at dealing with that one. About half of teachers are pretty good at dealing with, is this child not learning because they've got micro abnormalities in cortical layers and thus they have trouble learning to read, dyslexia, or are they just damn lazy and unmotivated? And I don't know, half of teachers, half of parents, half of guidance counselors have done that conceptual shift. So, you know, we've made a little bit of progress. And at the end of the day, I mean, sort of the mindset that I think we have to aim for is, if you have a car whose brakes don't work, you keep it off the street and you make sure it doesn't damage people. And if you could fix the brakes, that's great. And if you can't, you put it in a garage forever after. But never for a moment do you think that you are punishing the car by putting it in there, because it's whatever it is. And that's exactly where it has to wind up. And if the critique of that, which is the very frequent one, which is it's dehumanizing to turn us into cars in that case, that's a hell of a lot better than sermonizing us into being evil.
Wow. All right, I think we're going in.
Hi. Thank you for talking about my two favorite subjects, anthropology and biology, and some of the intersection. And I'd like to ask you a question because I feel like there's some defense need to be made. There's been a lot in the popular press about the reproducibility gap in the sciences in research, and I think it's going to hit us in funding and that kind of thing. And so, you know, could you talk a little bit? You know, a lot of the research regarding behavior hasn't been reproduced, and it's very difficult to reproduce. And so, could you talk a little bit about how you defend these rather difficult topics? And, you know, I think there's a lot of criticism, some of it justified, that there are, you know, fads in our thinking about some of these things in academia. But, you know, what do you have to say to kind of, you know, put it up there and, you know, make it more reasonable and more logical to you? I think there's an attack from people in the hard sciences and also lay people in this sort of intersection of the biological and social sciences.
Okay, what it usually means is you're asking about something very subtle where you don't know all the relevant variables yet. And somewhere between the first version and the attempt at a replication, one of those variables wasn't replicated exactly the same, wasn't set up experimentally exactly the same, and that variable that nobody in the world would have thought was relevant turns out to be relevant because we don't know all the influences yet. Wait, are you kidding? The judge gave a different decision reading the exact same sort of parole file. They gave a different decision yesterday than today because of their stomach gurgling. Oh, it's a failure of replication. No, actually, it turns out that's a relevant variable. It turns out that when you're looking at complex integrative things like behavior, the variables that matter are extremely subtle. Having said that, I mean, what you're tapping into nicely there is this sort of interdisciplinary snarkiness of, like, you know, every biologist wishes they were a biochemist, and every biochemist wishes they were a chemist, and every chemist a physicist, and the physicist the mathematicians, because the mathematicians only talk to God, kind of thing. The notion that as you get more reductive, in some way, you're more Joe Scientist with a real, like, I'm a scientist slapped on your forehead sort of certification. I did this study in the mid-'80s. It's the single biggest waste of time I've ever done in my research. But fortunately, most of the work was done by the student I got to help me, who was the most obsessive person I've ever met, thank God, because I exploited him shamelessly. The basic notion of sort of reductionism, sort of one implication of that is as you go from social science to biology to chemistry all the way down to more reductive levels, the notion there is you're getting cleaner answers the more reductive you get. You're getting closer to what the reality is. Because if you want to understand something complicated, you've got to break it down to its little component parts. And, you know, that's done great things for reductionism, sort of has helped us for about 800 years or so since it was, like, discovered by the West. Okay, so the assumption is translating that into data. As you go from data about social science all the way down to, like, physical chemistry, it's going to become less variable. There's going to be less noise in the data because there's less nonsense, distracting noise going on there. You're seeing more purely what's actually happening. So when you do scientific research, you do statistics, which is a measure of how variable the data are and how much it's likely to have happened by chance. And what that produces is a prediction that as you go to more reductive fields, statistical data should be less variable, cleaner, more reliable, more scientific. So this guy and I, what we did was we went through the entire literature from 10 years before, every study we could find on what testosterone had to do with behavior. And it ranged from sort of integrative whole-level biological anthropologists looking at testosterone levels in hunter-gatherers versus horticulturalists. So, okay, societal-type levels to testosterone levels in the bloodstream of individuals, more reductive down to testosterone interactions with testosterone receptors, all the way down to molecular biology of genes for constructing testosterone, and down to, like, X-ray crystallography of testosterone receptor interactions with testosterone. So going from big, smudgy, soft science, social science aspects, all the way down to the most reductive. So what this insane research assistant of mine did was go through every single one of these studies and look at every single data point and measured the size of the variability term, expressing it as a percentage of the average for that measure. If you care about such things, the coefficient of variation, as a measure of how noisy are the data. And the prediction was, as we went for the papers, we classified as integrative systems levels all the way down to single cell, subcellular, molecular, the amount of noise in the data should decrease. And what we got instead was a fractal system, which is the amount of variability was absolutely the same regardless of what level of magnification you looked at. In other words, more reductive systems don't get you closer to the real thing that's going on. It's simply telling you what's going on at a different level of analysis. So that was really interesting once this guy had recovered from that and sort of had handed in like all of his little rulers and stuff that he used for measuring. This was like thousands of measures he took.
Okay. I'm afraid we only have time for one more question.
Oh, okay.
I think we're going over here.
Hi. Just as a final brief point with that, it took me like 3 years to get anyone to publish the damn paper, and it's the only paper I've ever published which has never, ever been cited in another journal. It has had zero impact. No one has ever... Actually, one person read it. I got a series of very frenzied letters from some Russian mathematician who had read it and loved it, and his English was not very good. Either he wanted to adopt me or he wanted me to adopt him as a result of this paper. But other than that, it has had no impact whatsoever. Like, a lot of good that did.
Hi there.
Hi. So, humans are unique because, one among other things, they can be moved by reasons. Can you talk a little bit about the neurobiology and evolutionary history of how rather abstract things such as reasons can actually translate into behavior?
I'm sorry, reasons?
Yeah.
That's wonderful. I mean, we've got proportionally more cortex than any other species. And the picture that we have is the cortex spends an awful lot of time talking to the stuff down in the basement. The limbic system, which is about emotion, the cortex spending a lot of time saying, I wouldn't do that if I were you, or the cortex talking to the more ancient parts of the brain where we learn biofeedback and we can regulate our blood pressure, this picture of top-down regulation. What you see instead is bottom-up like crazy. All you have to do to appreciate that is the first time you make some stupid, irrational judgment about something just because you're in an emotionally aroused state. Oh, limbic emotional structures could influence the cortex. The cortex isn't this gleaming computer where the only time it ever interacts with limbic parts of the brain, it's there to like preach temperance and like savings or whatever. So the most interesting things about reason with that is that we could be moved to tears by something as abstract as a bunch of sound waves, an orchestra doing something, or that a bunch of ink on a piece of paper translates into instructions for how that orchestra could make that sound, which produces an emotion in us. Or if it's the right collection of dots on a page of paper, what that sound means is it's telling us, if it's the 1812 overture, it's telling us something about Napoleon getting his ass kicked outside of Moscow. And the phrase Napoleon getting his ass kicked is a stand-in for thousands of soldiers dying, freezing, and starving far from home. And just all these levels that any one of those somehow could pop out the other end, rippling with emotion that people could spend their whole lives trying to figure out a math problem or trying to figure out the abstract problem of the pains of somebody on the end of the planet where they've never seen the person's face, or trying to figure out a sub-microscopic or any of these, or being moved by this incredibly abstract state of a fictional character, it's utterly intertwined. And I think like some of the most amazing stuff we do is our capacity to feel just wildly intense, multicolored primate emotions for the most abstract possible things out there. And I think that is grounds for like some of our greatest human moments.
Robert, I want to thank you for a fascinating evening. Thank you for all your great questions.
Aloud is made possible through support provided by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, the National Endowment for the Arts, and Errant Fox. Additional support provided by the Los Angeles Public Library, the Stay Home and Read a Book Ball, Sharon Oxborough, the estate of Suzanne Aaron, Donna and Martin J. Wolf, Julia Meltzer, and individual Library Foundation members. Media support is provided by LA Weekly, KCRW 89.9 FM, and KUSC 91.5 FM. Music by Boya Pongo. Support these free programs by becoming a member of the Library Foundation of Los Angeles. Visit lfla.org for more information. 17.